Today is Tuesday, May the 10th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a potentially epic clash over transgender rights takes shape as North Carolina and the federal government fight it out. Anxiety over Donald Trump spreads among congressional Republicans, while the so-called Donald Trump of the East looks poised to win. Pop music takes Broadway by storm.
It brings younger people into the theater, which is vitally important. And it's how the medium will stay alive and thrive.
Also ahead, North Korea's ruling party Congress wraps up by giving its young leader a big title. It's all on today's International Edition. A controversial bathroom law in the state of North Carolina is turning into an all-out war between the state and the U.S. Justice Department. It requires transgender people to use restrooms that correspond to their gender at birth rather than their self-identified gender. The Justice Department last week said the state law violated civil rights standards. And then on Monday, the government made good on its promise by filing a lawsuit against the state. In making the announcement, U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch called the law state-sponsored discrimination.
Today, we are filing a federal civil rights lawsuit against the state of North Carolina, Governor Pat McCrory, the North Carolina Department of Public Safety, and the University of North Carolina. We are seeking a court order declaring HB2's restroom restriction impermissibly discriminatory, as well as a statewide bar on its enforcement.
But rather than abandoning the controversial law, the state's governor filed its own lawsuit against the U.S. government to keep it in place. VOA correspondent Michael Bowman has been following this story. I spoke with him earlier.
The state of North Carolina is suing the Justice Department, and the Justice Department is suing the state of North Carolina. At issue here is a bill that was passed in North Carolina and signed into law by the governor that targets transgender people. These are people that are born perhaps male, but later in life identify as female, or were born female, but later in life identify as male. And what the bill in North Carolina says is you have to use the bathroom that corresponds to your gender at birth. And this is very much targeting transgender people. And today, the Justice Department said that U.S. anti-discrimination law covers and protects transgender people, that they cannot be targeted in this fashion, that's a violation of federal law. And in the words of Attorney General Loretta Lynch, we stand with you.
What is the argument of North Carolina?
The argument of North Carolina is one of privacy and one of public safety. The concern that has been expressed is that if you allow transgender people to use the bathroom of their choice, then anyone could use the bathroom of their choice, and you could have a situation where predatory males go into the ladies' room and spy upon and prey upon women and girls in their most private moments, and that it's a matter of privacy and public safety.
But has there been any documented evidence that someone that is transgender going into a bathroom has ever caused any sort of problem?
I don't know that there is, but I highly suspect that if there were a case, that we would have heard about it by now. There are plenty of cases of males in particular spying on women in various locations, whether it's changing rooms in department stores or anywhere else. But transgender people specifically doing that, I am not aware of any case that I have heard, and I highly suspect, given the highly charged atmosphere of this case, that if there were a clear case of that, we would have heard of it by now.
What we have heard is that this issue really blowing up. There are a lot of musicians that are refusing to perform in the state. They're seeing a lot of backlash.
The corporation PayPal had planned a major expansion into North Carolina and has canceled that, and that's going to cost several hundred jobs to the state. Other corporations have put the state on notice that unless this changes, that any future expansions will also be placed on hold. canceled. Bruce Springsteen, The Boss, canceled a concert. Pearl Jam canceled a concert. This is having an impact, and certainly there is no shortage of attention being drawn to this case.
And there could be some other financial repercussions for North Carolina as well regarding university funding.
The Justice Department has not taken that step yet. However, under federal practices, when a state is out of compliance with federal law, it in essence gives up its right to various federal funds. And the federal government spends money all over the place, including in North Carolina, for its educational system and many other different purposes. So if the Justice Department did go to that length and did, it does have the ability, the Obama administration does have ability to throw a major financial wrench into North Carolina's finances.
And it doesn't seem like either side is really willing to back down. How far do you think this will go?
North Carolina is in a region of the country that, shall we say, has been particularly resistant to societal change going back decades. It has been most resistant to the expanding rights of gays and lesbians who last year won the right to marriage as a result of a Supreme Court decision. And some people, in fact, see this case involving transgender people and other cases when it comes to whether bakers have to bake cakes for same-sex weddings, that all of this is flowing and is sort of a reaction to last year's really landmark ruling when it came to same-sex marriage.
Thank you so much, Michael. We appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
Let's now turn to online reaction to the situation. We're joined in studio by VOA social media correspondent G. Abby Lee. Hi, G. What's happening with the Twitterverse?
Hi, Lori. It would be an understatement of the week to say North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory is sticking to his belief in the need for the so-called bathroom law in his state. He has three accounts on Twitter, at Pat McCrory NC, at GOV Office NC, and at Team _ McCrory. He mostly uses a first account. Now, when you go to his Twitter page, you can see he pinned his interview with Fox News' Megyn Kelly to the top of the page. And, of course, that interview is about the bathroom law. I'm not sure why, because I don't think he did a very good job during that interview, but it shows how important that is to his team. He also sent out two tweets about the controversial law Monday afternoon, and one of them got more than 1,000 likes. It reads like this: "We're taking the Obama administration to court. They are bypassing Congress, attempting to rewrite law and policies for the whole country, not just North Carolina."
And now, what's the public reaction to that tweet?
So many Twitter and Facebook users are not agreeing with him. One person wrote, "He is really committed to going down with the ship on this issue." Another person wrote, "His irrational fear and hatred of transgender citizens in North Carolina is only exceeded by his ignorance." Now, to the second tweet, one person asked, "How is keeping men out of women's bathrooms fear and hatred?" Implying that which bathroom to use should be decided based on sex at birth and not by gender or sex after a medical operation.
And what's the hashtag for this topic?
Hashtag StopHB2 is trending at this hour, and it stands for the House Bill 2, which is a formal name for the bathroom bill. Hashtag RepealHB2 is also popular, and I want to add Attorney General Loretta Lynch is also trending in relation to that topic.
And I'm sure there are other things that are trending. What else do you have today?
That's right. The Republican Party's presumptive nominee Donald Trump is also in the headlines again, this time because of New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Trump announced Monday that he picked Christie to head the possible transition committee ahead of the presidential election. Lori, back to you.
Thanks so much, G. Tweet your questions and comments to at @VOA_IE. You can also tag me and G on the tweets at Lori London and at G Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow International Edition stream at @VOA_IE. Here are some of the other top stories we're following here and around the world. A journalist group expands access to the Panama Papers. Cooler temperatures may start to tame aggressive Canadian wildfires. Social media rife with myths about the European refugee crisis. The UN urges Kenya to reconsider a plan to close refugee camps. Facebook scores a rare legal win in China. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on voanews.com or on our mobile app, VOA. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. The presumptive U.S. Republican presidential nominee, Donald Trump, is beginning to tap key advisors for a move to the White House should he win the November national election. Some prominent Republicans have declined to endorse him. The party's top current elected official, House of Representatives Speaker Paul Ryan, says he is just not ready to support Trump. The two men are set to meet Thursday in Washington to air their differences, but Trump says it is possible the two may just go our separate ways. Now, Americans, meanwhile, have a long and proud history of practicing democracy and voting for local and national candidates. But the current political election cycle is suggesting that the nation may have moved from its basic principles of every vote counts. But is it simple political strategy or winning at all costs? International Edition's Jim Stevenson investigates with Newsweek senior reporter Kurt Eichenwald.
If people want to celebrate American democracy, they have to start recognizing that they're going to lose. And losing is part of democracy. If they want to have a football team that they like to cheer for, it's going to lose sometimes. If they don't want to lose, that's fine. But then they should stop saying they're committed to democracy.
Tell me a little bit about the trends and what has been happening to our political system.
The biggest problem is that most Americans, and particularly politicians, have been gaining an increasing contempt for democracy, by which I mean the idea that one person, one vote, whoever gets the most votes wins. And you've seen that in a couple of areas right now. One was with Donald Trump, who was clearly winning the popular vote in the Republican Party. The Republicans wanted him, but until he won Indiana, the Republicans in Washington were trying to figure out some way to come up with their own more acceptable candidate that they liked. Trump may not be the candidate they like, but he's the one that people voted for. Bernie Sanders' people, when he's not winning the popular vote, his people started talking about ways to get what are called the superdelegates at the Democratic convention to turn their vote to him, despite the fact that he will walk in there with fewer votes from actual voters. It's part of the symptom. It's part of the overall trend towards how do we keep people who aren't like me away from the polls, how my mission is more important than my country.
Is it a case where the party in power gets a chance to write the laws that trickle down to the state level that affect how voters can or can't make it to the polls or the hoops they have to jump through to actually be able to vote?
Well, that's exactly it. But it didn't used to be like this. I mean, sure, back in the times of literacy tests and poll taxes, you know, those were intended to keep people that some might not want to vote from voting. But after the Civil Rights Movement and the Voting Rights Act of 1964, there was a general acceptance and agreement within the old political systems that people were supposed to vote, that it's supposed to be tantamount to a right. If we want to live in a democracy, why should people be impeded from voting? Now, the worst thing that's happened in all of this is that when you start blocking people from voting, and you start appealing to people's mindset of conspiracy theories, you end up where it's impossible to moderate anymore. The Republican elite is absolutely freaking out that Donald Trump has won the nomination. Well, guess what? That's a consequence of two things: their willingness to try and keep people away from the polls, and the last 8 years of conspiracy theories about Obama isn't an American, Obama wants to declare martial law, Obama wants to turn America over to the UN. I mean, Ted Cruz has said some of this stuff. Donald Trump was one of the original birthers, you know, saying that Obama was born in Kenya. And now this guy is running as the head of the party, and the Republicans are looking at the monster they've created and don't seem to understand why. Democracy would fix this, but people don't like democracy.
That's Kirk Eichenwald of Newsweek speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. His latest article, Don't Blame Trump, American Democracy Was Broken Before He Muscled In. Well, the man dubbed the Donald Trump of the East, Rodrigo Duterte, is poised to become the next Philippine president after taking an unassailable lead in Monday's elections, as voters there, much like in the United States, seem to be fed up with their current leaders. And much like the likely Republican presidential nominee, Duterte is a brash, tough-talking man who has made some very controversial statements. VOA's Victor Beatty talked about it with Fred Magdalena, the associate director of the Center for Philippine Studies at the University of Hawaii.
Rodrigo Duterte apparently is to become the next president of the Philippines. Are you surprised by the result?
I don't think people are surprised about his entering Malacañang, because all surveys pointed out that he's winning. I don't think people are really surprised about the results.
Are you concerned this could usher in a new Ferdinand Marcos-type dictatorship?
It's a different kind of strongman rule. It's something that you find in many places in the Philippines. I think Duterte would be a kind of strongman who would do away from the footsteps of Ferdinand Marcos.
There is some concern that the previous reformers like Gloria Arroyo and Benigno Aquino and others were very slow in the way they were going about reform. Is that the sense that they voters wanted somebody who's going to promise to speed things up?
I think that's the sentiment of many voters, especially those from the South. They are kind of disenchanted with the way things are done, especially by the last two administrations under Arroyo and lately under Aquino. So I guess that kind of disappointment among the voters, especially among the poor and middle-class groups of people, have led them to favor Duterte over the other presidential candidates.
He's made some interesting statements. One, he favors killing criminals. Do you consider this a very controversial position that will put him at odds with allies like the United States?
People take it both ways. Some believe that he is serious, but others think that he's just joking, you know. And although he doesn't smile whenever he cracks a joke about killing criminals, people in Davao don't really think that he really does that. Of course, there are reports about people being liquidated by the so-called Davao Death Squad, but this has not been proven to be true other than being considered an urban legend. For many, I think he sounds more like a joker than a serious killer or punisher.
Well, he may play well at home for some voters, but are you concerned about his position on the international stage vis-a-vis China and other countries?
One thing that he has to learn, I think, to be diplomatic. For over 20 years as a mayor of a big city, you know, he has not been exposed to foreign diplomacy. He should take advice from people who are more adept about dealing with foreign relations. Duterte should kind of mellow and listen to his advisors rather than to his own instincts.
And you can read more about the story on our website at voanews.com. North Korea expelled a team of BBC journalists Monday, apparently because officials were unhappy with their reports. They were detained Friday as they were about to leave the country. One correspondent was actually interrogated for 8 hours. The team joined 130 invited foreign journalists to cover the beginning of North Korea's Workers' Party Congress, the biggest political convention in generations. The unnamed official then was pressed by another BBC journalist, John Sudworth.
Could I put a question to the official? Could we ask whether you feel the international community will take a very dim view of inviting a foreign journalist into this country, preventing him getting on a flight, detaining him, interrogating him, simply because you don't like the content of his reporting?
And on Monday, the Congress announced a new title for the North Korean leader, party chairman. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on the Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is VOA's International Edition. The hip-hop musical Hamilton has been a smash hit on Broadway, and now two new musicals with original scores by pop stars Duncan Sheik and Sarah Bareilles are hoping to expand on the popular music's moment on Broadway in hopes of making going to theater cool again. Jeff London has our story.
Show tunes aren't necessarily on most people's playlists, but then the cast album of Hamilton came out.
Who are you? Who are you? Who are you? Who is this kid? What's he gonna do?
I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot.
The album debuted at number 12 on the Billboard 200 albums chart. That was the highest debut for a cast album since 1961.
Keith Caulfield keeps track of the charts at Billboard magazine.
So that already tells you something. And since then, it has sold more than 300,000 copies in the United States.
And it hit number one on the rap charts. Now, just for comparison, Beyoncé could probably sell 300,000 copies in 1 week. But Hamilton's numbers are still huge, and producers are hoping that a new crop of shows can use pop to bring in Broadway audiences. They used to. Lin-Manuel Miranda, the author and star of Hamilton, says a few generations ago, people listened to covers of Broadway tunes on the radio.
Musical theater in the 40s and 50s was the popular music. It was jazz. You would go hear a Cole Porter song on the radio, and then you'd go spend $10 to buy a ticket, hear that song on Broadway that night.
Strange dear, but true dear, when I'm close.
Caulfield says it wasn't just covers. People listened to cast albums, too. My Fair Lady, The Sound of Music, and Hello, Dolly actually topped the Billboard charts in the 1950s and 60s.
It was a normal occurrence to see musical shows on the charts. They, you know, ranked alongside Elvis Presley and Frank Sinatra back in the day.
So now some writers are hoping to breathe new life into an old tradition.
I am barely breathing, and I can't find.
Duncan Sheik became a pop star with the hit song Barely Breathing in 1996. He's written the score for stage adaptation of the novel American Psycho. Sheik thinks pop music is a good thing for Broadway.
What it does is it just broadens the audience hugely, and it brings younger people into the theater, which is vitally important. And it's how the medium will stay alive and thrive.
The streets are humming. I can feel what's coming. I say, uh-oh.
Sheik says the book and the movie have their rabid fans who are not your usual Broadway crowd.
I'm not gonna write you a love song, 'cause you asked for it, 'cause you need one.
Fans of singer-songwriter Sarah Bareilles are also not your usual Broadway crowd. but they are also coming out to hear her score for Waitress. It's based on an indie film set in a southern diner.
She's imperfect, but she tries. She is good, but she lies. She is hard on herself. She is broken and won't ask for help.
Bareilles notes that her loyal fan base is packing the theater every night.
That has been really satisfying for me, to get feedback online or through, you know, my fan community of people who have never been to the theater before. And they're coming, yes, some of them just as fans of mine, but also curious about this new project. It's sort of outside the box for me, and they are being introduced to a whole new medium.
It's a bad idea, me and you. It's a bad idea, me and you.
Having pop stars write for Broadway is not a bad idea, says Billboard's Keith Caulfield. But he cautions, for every hit, there are several flops.
You know, it's always a dicey proposition when you have a pop star come to Broadway. It's not always necessarily going to work. And so just because we're in this moment right now where Hamilton is doing gangbusters on Broadway does not necessarily mean that any other show that kind of has a pop feel is going to be a huge success as well.
But even against tough odds, more pop stars with Broadway shows are waiting in the wings, like Sheryl Crow, who's written a new musical based on the film Diner. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of International Edition. Join us again tomorrow, same time, same place. You can also find us at voanews.com, like us on Facebook, VOA Now, or follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Thanks so much to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Jimmy Cook, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a wonderful, wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
If global climate change is the defining challenge of our time, as both President Barack Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry have stated on numerous occasions, then the Paris Climate Agreement is the first step toward meeting it head-on. Last December 12th, 195 countries adopted the Paris Agreement, which establishes a global framework to reduce global greenhouse gas emissions and sets a goal for all parties that includes keeping the temperature rise well above 2 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial levels. In order to do so, the world will need to move toward a clean energy economy. Paris was a turning point in the fight against climate change, said Secretary of State John Kerry.
Paris marked the moment when the world finally decided to heed the ever-rising mountain of evidence that had been piling up for years. It marked the moment that we put to rest once and for all the debate over whether climate change is real and began instead to galvanize our focus on how, as a global community, we are going to address the irrefutable reality that nature is changing at an increasingly rapid pace due to our own choices.
On April 22nd, a signing agreement took place at the United Nations in New York. Over 170 parties, including the United States, signed the agreement, and over a dozen have already joined. But in order for the agreement to go into effect, it must first be accepted, approved, or ratified by at least 55 parties that collectively emit at least 55% of the world's greenhouse gases. After joining the Paris Agreement, countries will begin to implement the agreement so that the world can accelerate the transition to low-carbon, climate-resilient economies. The urgency of this challenge is only becoming more pronounced, said Secretary of State John Kerry. The United States looks forward to formally joining this agreement this year, and we call on all of our international partners to do so.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.